Now, it's no secret that a lot of bad stuff happens online, from individual cases of harassment to massive campaigns orchestrated by governments or extremist movements. In the early days of the internet, the hope was that it could be a tool of free expression, one that could even help overthrow authoritarian regimes. But now those authoritarian governments have harnessed the power of the internet as an instrument of control, and in many cases, use it to disrupt democratic societies. Our next guest says democracy is under attack online, and it needs defenders who understand what's going on. Britton Heller is a counsel for the law firm Foley Hoag. She's also a technology and human rights fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School Carr Center for Human Rights Policy. She's giving a talk this Wednesday night on UW-Madison's campus, 7 p.m. at the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. The title is The Digital Authoritarian's Toolbox, How to Protect Digital Democracy. Britton, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
The digital authoritarians. This is not a household phrase, I think. Who are we talking about?
For digital authoritarians, basically, we're talking about governments and non-state actors who decide that they're going to use disinformation campaigns to tighten control over citizens' data and basically suppress dissent. What this does is it erodes trust in the internet as well as the foundations of democracy.
That's something that an authoritarian government could do to its own citizens. It also is something they might try in other countries, too, a weaponized authoritarianism online. Is that something that concerns you here in the United States, Europe, and elsewhere?
We've seen this phenomenon pop up all over the world. I personally, as an American, am very concerned about the U.S. elections, but if you look at elections all around the world, especially in the global south, you'll see governments using that as kind of a laboratory to check, see the best ways to reach their goals.
Who are some of the worst cases around the world when it comes to this digital authoritarianism? Who are the worst case stories that we should all worry about?
I tend to focus more on the goals of the authoritarians than on where they're located, because with the internet, they can pop up anywhere. So there's three things that a digital authoritarian wants to do. First, they want to create domestic chaos and fear, and they do this by exacerbating pre-existing social fissures in a society. Second, they try to silence voices and target influencers. And third, they try to leverage or even opportunistically warp the efforts of people who are trying to protect human rights and freedom of expression.
What does that look like on the ground? What would the internet user, first of all, within a country using these techniques, what would they experience and see?
Well, if you look at the Senate Intelligence Committee report that was released in October, it talks about how the Internet Research Agency, which is a troll farm out of St. Petersburg, showed an overwhelming operational emphasis on race in all of the posts that it made on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And the intended goal, it seems, was to demoralize and divide African-American voters and amplify racial tensions in U.S. society. About two-thirds of the Russian activity on social media that was trying to influence the 2016 election was aimed at African Americans, according to this report. And you can actually see this manifest in really specific communities. Like, some of this activity was focused on Charlotte, North Carolina, where more than a few people in the community were fooled by Russian social media accounts in the wake of riots rocking the city after a police shooting of one of the residents. One of the IRA's most popular Instagram accounts, Blackstagram, attracted 300,000 followers. And they, the IRA also took out advertisements on social media to stir emotions after the police shootings. And one account on Facebook called Blacktivist garnered millions of likes, shares, and comments.
I think in the early days of the internet, Britton, the thought was there's something about this technology that's going to be inherently anti-authoritarian. It's going to put, you know, the control in the hands of people sitting at their computers wherever they are around the world. Have we been slow to recognize the way that, authoritarian governments and non-state actors have used it to their own ends?
I think that this is a very old game, but these are very new tools. So I'm not surprised when I see that the type of activity that goes on, like trying to suppress voters, but the fact that you can now shut down the internet in certain areas of the world, and this is commonplace around elections, takes it to a new level.
Talking to Britton Heller with the law firm Foley Hoag and the Kennedy School Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard. She is giving a talk in Madison this week, The Digital Authoritarian's Toolbox, How to Protect Digital Democracy. Let's get to the protection side of things. What kind of protections are you looking for here?
I think the number one thing that I would say to people who were worried would be to vote. When you look at the disinformation that is coming out of all of these regimes, they're trying to disrupt the process. And back in 2016, much of the disinformation coming out of Russia was trying to convince people that their vote didn't matter. So by trying to convince people to remove themselves from the process, they were really trying to undermine the way the American political system works. So if you're concerned about it at all, vote. I think you can also try to recognize that the pattern of how disinformation works when you see it on social media. The basic pattern is always the same, and a scholar named Ben Nimmo calls it the four Ds of disinformation: dismiss, distort, distract, and dismay. To kind of summarize it, people always dismiss the speaker online, they distort the facts, they distract from the main point, or they dismay their targets to try to silence or stop them from taking action. So if you keep that in mind when you're looking at your social media, think critically when you see political posts, especially around an election.
I talked to Danielle Citron, who has been writing about these issues as well, and she says it's really easy for somebody running a disinformation campaign to win, because they win if you believe what they said, but they also win if you disbelieve it and then go on to lose trust in everything. You get demoralized. How do we defeat something like that that has two ways of beating us?
I think the point is to be an engaged voter, to learn as much as you can about the issues that you care about, to make sure that the sources that you're looking at aren't just your trusted friends and neighbors, but also scientific evidence, think tanks, governments. Really educate yourself to a variety of points of view before you come to your conclusion.
Now, that's the individual user. How about the platforms, the Facebooks and Twitters and Instagrams and on of the world? Do they have a responsibility to try to rein in these authoritarian efforts?
I think that some of the things that they can do, and that they've just started to do now, are to basically think about these type of risks in the same way they think about hacking and other cybersecurity risks. So to have a risk-based allocation of resources, look to where customer bases or users are most vulnerable, and this is often around elections or social unrest, and to reallocate a lot of their staff and their resources and their attention there during that time. The platforms will say that they don't have a lot of extra resources, and I think that's actually true, but that doesn't mean that they can't concentrate them when we know that there's going to be a flurry of activity.
What's their incentive to do that? If they have lots of users, if they're making money under the system as it is, what's going to get them to take active measures to counter this kind of disinformation?
I think that people lose trust in their platform when they find that it's been used as a tool to undermine our political processes. One of the things that I think platforms can do is, instead of just looking at, and this helps them get around the First Amendment question, is instead of looking at actors, and instead of looking at content, to really look at behaviors. And that's something that the platforms themselves have to do, because nobody else, not really government without process, not private citizens, not really academics, but nobody else has a window into the type of behaviors that they're seeing on the back ends. And so that is something that they can do. And if they don't do that, the public will lose trust.
We're talking to Britton Heller from the Harvard Kennedy School Carr Center about what tools digital authoritarians are using to disrupt our democracy online. Britton will be giving a talk on this topic at UW-Madison on Wednesday evening at 7 at the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. And you can join in now at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about how authoritarian movements or governments spread disinformation online? When you're at your computer, at your phone, how do you look out for bad actors, foreign bots, bad information maybe being spread by somebody you know, maybe somebody you know and love? Do you call people out for sending bad information to you? Call 800-642-1234. And have you ever, you know, hit send or share on something and later realized it wasn't true? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue the conversation about threats to democracy from some repressive regimes and other actors online. Britton Heller is with us from Foley Hoag Law Firm and the Harvard Kennedy School Carr Center for Human Rights Policy. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about various entities online spreading misleading false information? How do you spot it in your own online life, if at all? What questions do you have about identifying it and how to react to it? What do you think the responsibility of the Facebooks of the world or governments of the world should be on trying to rein this in? Call 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Dan is with us in Green Bay. Dan, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Dan?
Well, I hate to be a pessimist, but I am concerned that we're a little too late. For instance, you can make the argument that they chose our last leader here in the United States, those folks, nefarious folks out there that are manipulating us like puppets. Also, the things we may need to do, you might not be able to do in a free society. So even if we could, we'd start to look like them. Just wanted your expert's opinion on that.
Dan, thanks a lot for the call. Let's tackle both of those points. Barn door open, horse is already gone, Britton.
Well, I remember this quote that said that the point of disinformation was not to make people believe what is true to be false, but rather to make people doubt that anything was true at all. So the thing that I focus on is not losing hope and not taking the point of view that there is nothing we can do. The type of research that I've done, I did a study that looked at the online characteristics of hate speech using artificial intelligence with the D-Lab at UC Berkeley. And we were trying to figure out what hate speech looked like when it was directed at immigrants. And the results that came back were actually very surprising. The top four results were black, white, man, woman, and Jew. So it looked rather strange because we thought that anti-immigrant hate speech was going to look like a civil rights violation, like targeted specific hatred at a specific group. But what it really looked like was people basically targeting everyone and trying to stir the pot. So I think that one of the things that we can do to not lose hope is to make sure that we stand up for people who we see being targeted online. And this is because the trolling and online harassment and trying to make Americans hate each other is the ultimate goal of digital authoritarians. And so I'm hoping that horse hasn't left the barn yet, because it's all about basically taking care of your neighbors and reminding ourselves that we're all part of the same community and we sink or swim together.
And Dan's other point, maybe on the landscape of the internet, we as an open society are at a disadvantage. There are limits to how much we want to control things as compared to an authoritarian, say, government. So what do you say to that?
Well, I think if you look at freedom of expression, it's the way it expresses itself in the United States versus the way it expresses itself in Europe or in case law throughout the European Union or around the world. Freedom of expression doesn't mean that you can say whatever you want. And I think Americans sometimes get confused about that. There have always been limits on freedom of expression. Like, people talk about you can't scream fire in a crowded theater. You can't threaten imminent violence. And so I think that there still are ways that under the law, we can look at online speech. I think the more interesting question for me is online speech a little different? Because people talk about you have freedom of speech, but does that imply freedom of reach, right? Because of the amplification problem. So that's something I think that we don't have an answer for yet, and something that I continue to think about.
Let's go back to our callers now. Jim is with us in Dubuque, Iowa. Jim, hello.
Hi. I don't think there's any government that's more pervasive and effective at malicious internet activity than our own. We need to look at the revelations of Edward Snowden and the funding by our intelligence and defense industry in the establishment of Facebook and Google.
Jim, thanks for the call. Jim saying the United States is not at all blameless here. What do you think, Britton?
Well, I think that looking at shutting down avenues of information and dissent is actually a global phenomenon. And oftentimes you see governments doing this in the name of combating disinformation or hate speech. The Freedom House is an NGO, and they put out a report about the state of the internet. And so during one week in January 2019, there were actually internet disruptions where the governments shut down full access to the internet in Sudan, Ethiopia, Algeria, Venezuela, Liberia, and Kazakhstan. So this happens all around the world, and we haven't really hit that point in the United States yet. So you can kind of see a spectrum when you're looking at access to information, especially around elections. And it goes from turning off the internet all the way to spreading disinformation about where people vote to trying to discourage people from going to the ballot box in the first place.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Britton Heller. She is talking about authoritarian abuses of the internet, misinformation, disinformation, and what to do about it. We asked our listeners to comment with their thoughts on what they see on the internet and social media, Britton, on our Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Chris, who says she tries to check verifiable sources, and she goes on, "I do not trust anything on Facebook at all. There's too much news being based on opinion, not facts and expertise. Rumor is just that, rumor, unconfirmed, and should be reported as unconfirmed." Do we need to distinguish the types of things we see on the internet, rumor, opinion versus reliable news articles?
I think that our commentator is right. And if you look, most people are worried about their data. There was a study that actually came out today from the Knight Foundation, and they talked about how a bipartisan majority of people, 88%, say that their biggest concern is misuse of data. And they say that technology platforms shouldn't provide any information to political candidates' campaigns so they can better reach voters online. And I think that this is interesting because both Democrats and Republicans agreed on this front. When you're looking at sources online, what I tend to do is make sure that the news sources that I'm going to are professionalized news sources, and then you can even take it one more step back and to see where they're getting their information from. Platforms like Facebook actually will have a mechanism now where you can go and you can see what the fact checkers that they've employed say about the sourcing of these stories coming online. But I think the caller seems to have the right impulse to be a little skeptical about the things you see online until you verify, and then you trust.
Is there something about the medium, though, that makes it difficult to do this, Britton? Because, you know, part of the appeal of Facebook or Instagram or whatever is that you breeze through lots of stuff, get a little taste of lots of different things. We don't really want to dig deeper and take extra time for each and every piece of information we see.
That's part of the challenge of democracy, I think. Democracy takes work. And so if we're interested in the bite-sized soundbite form of democracy, that's exactly the type of rights we're going to get. So,
in our last minute or so, what's the next thing you're watching for? What's the next trend, either on the interference side or on the defense side of digital authoritarianism?
Two things. One, I look for the mixing of legitimate political expression from Americans with foreign actors. That is something that the foreign actors have been trying to do, where they sort of set the gears in motion and then try to get Americans to pick up the football from there. And that is really hard to do because that creates big questions about freedom of expression and political participation when many people don't know that they are being unwilling accomplices to this sort of thing. Second is I'm looking at hate speech and online harassment that targets minority groups, because that seems to be a very specific tactic to make Americans hate each other. And I see that there's a study from the Institute for the Future about 10 different minority groups being targeted online, and the Oxford Internet Institute did the same thing with gender. So looking at the way we hate each other online and how that is designed to undermine our political processes.
Britton, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. This was really fun.
That's Britton Heller, counsel for Foley Hoag and fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School Carr Center for Human Rights Policy. She focuses on legal issues of technology, human rights, and business. We talked to her today about protecting digital democracy. Britton will be giving a talk on this topic at UW-Madison. That's this Wednesday evening at 7 at the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery.